We all know that behind every great failed idea is a senior executive, and that's why we had to make sure that we brought them on board.
Hello, listener. You are very welcome to episode 86 of Good Copy, Bad Copy, the B2B Copywriting Podcast. This month, we're talking about big ideas in your B2B content and how you bring your stakeholders along for the ride. We have a brilliant, brilliant interview coming up with Mwamba Kasanda of Bearings about just how much work she did behind the scenes when she was at Korn Ferry to enable an ambitious, award-winning global campaign. I'm David Maguire, Creative Director at Radix Communications, and I'm delighted to say our guest co-host this episode is B2B marketing consultant Angela Catton from Interalia Marketing. Angela, welcome.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. How are things? How's lockdown treating you?
Lockdown's been pretty kind, so I'm feeling very thankful that my clients have been keeping me busy the past few months, and delighted that the coffee shops are now open. So that's the main excitement in my life.
Yeah. Get your mask on, get in there, and get your coffee. You kind of mentioned your clients there. What clients are you working with Interalia, and what kind of things are you doing for them?
So I'm working with tech businesses primarily. So working with small businesses, larger SMEs, local businesses, global businesses. So it's quite mixed at the moment, which is great. Keeps me busy and lots of variety. I'm working with them with marketing consultancy, looking at their strategy, helping them with new websites, content, the full mix, really. So, yeah, lots going on and keeping busy.
Yes, keep you out of trouble. Across all of those businesses, I suppose you've got quite a good perspective on how the world has changed for them over these last sort of 3 or 4 months. Is it something where it's really, really different for every business, or are there sort of some themes in these B2B tech businesses that have kind of they've got in common during lockdown?
Yeah, I'm sure it's different for every brand, but I'm finding certainly in the early days of lockdown that the brands and businesses I was working with and still am were really taking stock of marketing and really seeing the lockdown period as a time to readdress some of the foundations with content, website, campaign planning. So that was a real bonus for a lot of the businesses because they all have taken that opportunity and realised that certainly in the early days, businesses didn't want to see that big sales push. There was lots of messages out there. And they took a step back and said, now's the time to really look at what we're doing. And I've seen that through a number of businesses that I'm working with and others as well. I suppose the other obvious shift is the move to virtual events, which hopefully will remain post-lockdown. Gives me the opportunity to attend some events rather than travel to London, for example. So that'll be quite nice if that remains in place.
Yeah, so you're up in Chester at the moment, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Goodness. Well, I mean, as you can obviously hear, listener, we are still recording in a socially distanced way, and in this case, very socially distanced. I mean, I'm down in Cornwall, Angela's up in Chester, so we're very spread out. The audio quality, of course, might not be quite what you're used to from us, but please do bear with us. It is a corking episode that we have lined up. Angela, would you like to tell the listener how they can get in touch?
Of course. Listener, you can email the show on podcast@radix-communications.com. Or you can find us on Twitter at RadixCom, that's RadixCom.
Excellent, thank you very much.
As an interim marketing lead, I see firsthand how important stakeholders are if marketers are to get anything done. So I'm really interested to hear this interview. David, you spoke to Mwamba Kasanda about the unseen work that went into an award-winning campaign.
Yeah, that's right. Now, Mwamba works at Bearings now, but back previously, when she was at Korn Ferry, she spearheaded this ambitious, multiple award-winning campaign called the Global Talent Crunch. She worked on it with Man Bites Dog, I think. And I wanted to know what it took to get stakeholders on board with an idea that big. I started by asking about the context behind the campaign.
Korn Ferry had recently made its largest acquisition of management consulting firm Hay Group, which is where I came from. And what the company wanted to do was present itself in a new way, to present itself as a people and organizational consulting firm. So this required having a team, and that's the team that I led, to tell one Korn Ferry story. So these were stories that had to show what the new organization looked like in terms of the combined services, the combined cultures, the combined sectors and products as well. So what we did was create campaigns to try and tell these stories. We started off with quite a small campaign that was called The Future of Work is Human. And this is a platform that we developed alongside some consultants by the names of Man Bites Dog. And with this campaign, we were looking at the people side of the people technology equation. And the campaign was actually, at that point, a little bit of an experiment. And it actually worked. And what happened is we actually won our first award with that smaller campaign. And what that did was it set the foundation for our multi-year Future of Work campaigns. And that's where the talent crunch came in. That was the next phase. And it was a campaign that was larger than anything Korn Ferry had done before.
So where did the idea for the first campaign come from? And how did you then grow that into the second campaign?
Yes, that's a great question. So the first campaign really came from our research agenda. So on the Hay Group side, we had a research agenda, and the research team had decided that we were going to make sure that we were an authority around all things future of work related. But what we knew that we needed to do, because at that time, the marketplace was very, it was already quite saturated with other stories around the future of work. So we knew we needed a slant on it, a perspective that we could own. And that was the people side of the equation. Because so far in the market, everything that was being talked about was the importance of technology. And we wanted to bring people back into the equation. So that's when we worked on the initial campaign of The Future of Work is Human. And then taking that to the next level with the talent crunch, we decided to look at it on a broader scale. So for the first campaign, we only looked at 8 countries. But for the next campaign, we decided that what we wanted to do was look at it on a broader scale and bring in some hard numbers that would make business leaders interested in the campaign rather than just, for example, the HR community.
So you're talking about a campaign in the end that's bigger than what Korn Ferry have done before. And they started with talking about the future of work. And obviously, stakeholders will have had an idea about what they wanted, anticipated that would look like. What you ended up with, I guess, was something kind of quite different. When you were coming up with these ideas, were you anticipating any kind of pushback? Or, you know, how was that?
Yeah. So what we did, and this was, as mentioned, alongside Man Bites Dog, is we started off by interviewing quite a few people from around the business before embarking on the talent crunch. So I pulled together a virtual brainstorming session where we had people from different parts of the business that were thought leaders in their own right. And we just brainstormed ideas around the concept of the future of work, what they were seeing in the marketplace, what we should be talking about. And after these brainstorming sessions, I went away with Man Bites Dog and actually pulled together what the concept would actually be. So we had all of the ideas, but we actually needed to pull it together into a really succinct concept. And with Man Bites Dog help, we were able to do that. And that's when we came up with the concept of the talent crunch. And at that time, it was actually called the talent time bomb, because we said there's a ticking time bomb here.
Sure.
In terms of the fact that there's going to be a skills talent shortage. And we were saying business leaders actually sleepwalking into this reality.
Wow. So, I mean, a couple of things there. I mean, the first thing is, so from the point of view that you had people engaged in the genesis of the idea, it wasn't hopefully that much of a surprise when you were kind of reflecting their idea back to them. Is what you came back with sort of then what they expected because they'd been involved?
Exactly. But it had even gone further than they than the point they'd got to. So it was a lot richer in terms of what we came back with. And it gave them a concept that they could think about and actually add more of their thoughts to. Exactly.
And then from then they were on board. And then obviously, you know, for reasons of sensitivity and one thing and another, where you modified the idea from the talent time bomb to the talent crunch, was that something that, you know, was done in discussion or there was a particular stakeholder pushback? And at the time, was it like, no, this is my idea. You know, why are you changing my idea? Or, and how much of it was, yeah, actually, that probably is a sensible thing to do. How did that evolution happen with that refining of the idea?
Yeah, that's again, a very good question. That change actually happened at the 11th hour. It was right. Actually at the very last moment. So having the name, the Talent Time Bomb, as we were thinking of the idea and discussing it in the organization was actually really helpful because it was so memorable. Everybody immediately knew what we were talking about when we spoke about the Talent Time Bomb. And one of the other things that we did as well to bring stakeholders on board was instead of waiting till the entire idea was fully baked, we started to talk to lots more people around the business about the idea. We broadened out the net in terms of who our stakeholders were, and we started to engage them early. So we had the vision, we had the memorable name, but we didn't have the blueprint. But we started to engage them around the idea, and engaging them early was incredibly important because we were getting their buy-in. And again, we were picking up more of their ideas. Even the idea of coming up with the three different milestones came up from one of those discussions with a stakeholder who made the comment, I love what you're saying. I could imagine myself having this conversation over dinner, but I can't imagine a client actually wanting to do something about it immediately. And so we thought, this is when we put in the milestones to create a sense of urgency.
Wow. I think the thing about that compared to a lot of the research that we've done about the kinds of relations that a lot of marketers have with their stakeholders is that that's so incredibly constructive. Were there times where there were things where you had to compromise on things that maybe you didn't want to, and how far did the finished idea end up compared to what you thought it was going to be?
Actually, so the name and that was one of the things that I did have to compromise on, because this is a global campaign, so it needed to have global appeal. And in some of the regions, it wasn't landing well as the Talent Time Bomb. And I remember one particular stakeholder who was critical to making sure that this campaign sailed through. He couldn't get past the name. So at the last minute, we did change it. And I'm glad we did, because it meant that everybody was on board, and he was a critical and very important stakeholder, and went on to talk about the campaign internally with such authority and brought more people along with him. But in terms of the idea, one of the things that I talk about is the importance of knowing what battles to fight, where to compromise and when not to. And the idea, keeping the purity of the idea, is one thing that I fought for as it made its way through the organization. And that was really about engaging people early and engaging the entire marketing network, engaging the most important and even in some instances the most difficult stakeholders, but making sure that they were part of the conversation early.
Yeah, and that part with it very early on, and you're coming up with a piece of content or you're coming up with a campaign and you don't know what it's going to be yet, so it's quite unformed. How easy or how hard was it to get stakeholders to participate in something that isn't defined. That, I'm thinking about that initial brainstorm. Was that easy to get them to come along for the ride there? How did you do that?
The brainstorm was fun. So that was the easy part of it. The brainstorm, the ideation portion of coming up with the campaign is the fun bit, because that's when everybody can dream, everybody can put any idea on the table. No idea is a bad idea. However, you're absolutely right. When we started having the early conversations with nothing behind it, it was really about trying to make sure it was a compelling narrative and a narrative where they could see the benefit to the organization and how the stakeholders could have conversations with clients about the campaign, because it needed to make sense for our organization. It needed to lead eventually, of course, to sales. So they needed to see that link, and having those conversations showed them how we could make that link. But of course, there were some stakeholders that weren't bought in completely. And you're absolutely right. At that point, we needed to show them some pilot data. And Man Bites Dog saved the day by going away and thinking about how can we provide some data to help get those final few stakeholders across the line. Once Man Bites Dog had done that, I was able to then continue presenting throughout the organization, and people were bought in once they started to see that there was actually data that could underpin or support our, at that point, our, what's the word, David? You know what I mean? Our our theory.
Your approach, yeah.
Yes.
So it's interesting. We hear a lot that data can really change the conversation. I'm interested in the small campaign that won an award that was then almost like a down payment, you know, for the big campaign. Internally, when you're managing your stakeholders, was that sort of did that initial campaign kind of work as a proof of concept? Did that make things easier, or was that just a nice to have?
I think it did make things easier, but the really good thing with having the smaller campaign is I learned a lot. Because with the smaller campaign, as mentioned, the Korn Ferry had just acquired Hay Group at the time. So what I did with that campaign is, again, I pulled together a virtual brainstorming session. I put together a communication around the vision that we had for this campaign. So people were interested in it. I had around 18 to 20 people from across the business join the brainstorming session. So I had to hold brainstorming sessions at different times of the day. I also had one of our consultants from the Hay Group side, who is a seasoned facilitator, help me with the brainstorming session. And so we had representation across the new combined organization. So the brainstorming session was exciting and energizing. People were fully on board. But the mistake that I made with that campaign, the learning that I had, is I then went away and sort of hid for about 4 months in a dark corner, pulling everything together with Man Bites Dog, and sort of emerged with this campaign. And there was a lot of work to do in terms of showing people how we went from the brainstorming to the actual campaign idea. People liked the campaign idea, but there was a lot more work that I had to do, because I had to go back and connect the dots from where we started to where we are now. And after 4 months of silence, 3 to 4 months of silence, it wasn't ideal. So I'd learned from that experience and was able to then use that learning with the talent crunch, and actually knew that I need, and it's a dangerous thing, of course, to include people in an idea when it's very early on and it can completely change. But I was more comfortable taking that risk and taking people along the journey with me, people that could help to protect the idea as it made its way through the organization, rather than making the same not learning from what I'd from the past experience. So it's a good point. But having the award win for the first one, yes, absolutely helped.
Thinking about, you know, the data and the evidence, I mean, all the plaudits and the award wins and the speaking at big events about the campaign and all of that stuff, it is great. I'm interested in anything you could share about the business side of it. You know, was it something that achieved its objectives, and how did the results compare with maybe less bold, less ambitious campaigns that the organization had run in the past?
So this campaign was the first of its kind. So I don't think that there was any proper comparison to what had happened in the past. This was about taking campaigns to the next level. And even we had done that with the first tiny campaign. And then there was another campaign, actually, that was done by another group within the business that also helped to make that next step. And then this one took the next leap again. One of the things that I was really clear on from the outset to make sure that it did have business impact is I made sure that the campaign was not considered as a marketing campaign or a marketing program. It was really a business initiative. That's how I was talking about it within the business, and talking about, you know, how it was going to be used with clients. So we had a global champion. So I had one global champion who was in the business, who I worked closely with. And for every single one of the countries that was covered by our data, we had at least one champion in those countries who partnered with marketing. So that's how we made sure that it was aligned to the business, that it wasn't just paying lip service, that this was going to be something that we can actually sell off the back of, because we made sure that it was aligned to our actual offering. So that was the critical thing. In terms of the results, the PR results were phenomenal. We had over 600 pieces of coverage globally and in major publications, not just in the HR press, but it was also in BBC. We had Les Echos, we had Die Welt in Germany, we had the Evening Standard, etc. So it was a campaign that actually had a global impact and reached business leaders through the PR medium. The other thing is that it also opened up conversations. So people used it in client conversations. It actually generated revenue as well. So it generated millions of dollars very early on in the campaign, and I believe has continued to do so.
Brilliant. So it's great to hear that, you know, that this approach that you took all the way through to take this campaign to the next level, you know, did obviously kind of, you know, deliver, you know, on all the business objectives as well. It wasn't just a nice award-winning thing to do. So thinking back, you know, to the marketers that are listening, you know, that they've got, you know, the idea of a big campaign, the idea of a bold or very different piece of content that they, you know, that they want to get out in the world, but you know, they doubt whether when they, you know, bring it to the stakeholders that it would fly. What would you say to those people, and what would you advise them?
I would advise them to absolutely engage with their stakeholders early. Engage with them by even using the same tactic that you're going to use out in the market to tell a story, to tell your story internally. Like, treat your stakeholders as if they're that they're an external party. The other thing that I would say is to partner with the business, making sure that this is not seen as something that belongs in the marketing department, but really something that is seen as a business initiative. I'd also say that make sure you get marketing on board. One of the things that I did to engage the entire marketing network was really think about how I could support their success. Because really what you want to do is get everybody to feel like they own the campaign, that this isn't something that you own yourself or your team owns. Everybody should feel like they are part of the success story. Another thing is, as you're thinking about the different channels to market, is understanding that your most effective channel to market are the people on the front lines, the people that talk to clients every single day. And that's why you need to engage the people within the business, because you want them to talk fluently about the campaign to their clients. And that is a critical differentiator, rather than people seeing an advertisement, an email, but when they have their actual contact within the client, when they have their actual contact within the business talking to them about the campaign, it's much more powerful, and the that person can also put it into their context, into their world, and make it relevant for where they are right now.
Yeah, that's amazing. Can I just ask you briefly about how you do that for people on the front line, people who are, they're busy, they're serving their clients, you know, they've got their relationships, they've got their targets to hit. And then you've got marketing coming along going, hey, here's a new campaign that you can use to tell a story to your clients. How do you actually get them to engage with that beyond here's another email, here's something else to do on top of your job?
By making sure that it's relevant to the area of business that they are connected to. So they need to be able to see how they can use it to open up a conversation, how they can use it to have an excuse to call up a client, how they can use it to make a sale. So it's making that connection, and having those global champions is critical, because they can help you to put your marketing campaign into the language that their colleagues, their client-facing colleagues, understand. So if, and it's also about your global champion helping you to have these conversations. So one of the things that I also did was set up a lot of different calls around the business at different times, and going in to talk to different groups of people. So joining meetings that had already been set up within the business, and joining those meetings and having a slot to talk about the campaign. And ideally you would do this alongside your business champion, your campaign champion.
So clearly that global network of champions was key, but then how did you get them involved?
Yeah, so with the champions, I actually pulled together an instruction pack for them. So they had a champions pack, which showed them what was expected of their role, what was expected of marketing. So there was a social contract between the champions and marketing, what is expected of their role and what they in turn can expect from marketing. So it was really clear what they were signing up to. I also helped the marketers in terms of thinking of the criteria a global champion needed to have in order to be an ideal champion. So they were able to pick the right people within the business, because that's also an important thing, is picking the right champion. This has to be somebody who is able to influence others around the business. This has to be somebody who does have, who is passionate about the campaign and will actually help you, partner with you to get the campaign through.
Sounds like you've done more work internally than externally on this campaign. Is it like one of these iceberg things where the stuff that's out in the world that won the awards, that got the business results, was only possible because there was a great deal more unseen work inside the organization? Was the time spent working on the stakeholders as great or even greater than working on the external assets?
I think you're absolutely right. And that was the learning taken from the first campaign, that I hadn't done enough with the internal organization. So yes, a lot of the groundwork has to be done internally for it to be successful externally, because you want everyone internally being consistent with how they go out into the market. So they needed to be equipped with all the information that they need and feel comfortable enough to be able to talk about it instead of trying to find the information that they need 2 minutes before a client conversation. They had all of that information up front. But you're absolutely right. And yes, the work that was done externally was so much easier because there was an army of people around the business that were comfortable with the campaign and were able to talk about it, that people within the business started to find their own opportunities to talk about the campaign. If they hadn't been fully engaged up front, then there would be a lot more work that marketing had to do in terms of finding new opportunities or any opportunities to talk about the campaign externally.
Thanks, Mwamba, for being so open about your process. I found it really enlightening. Angela, were there things in there that sounded familiar from the kinds of organisations that you work with?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And what a fabulous interview and some incredibly valuable insights. I think for me, early engagement was the obvious one. That really resonated. If there's ever anything I've learned over the years, it's involving stakeholders early, even when we don't always want to. We all know too many cooks. We're always a bit scared about involving certain stakeholders in case they're going to quash our creativity. But if you don't involve them early, it's just going to come back to bite you later on. So that was a really key point that came out
there. And it was so early as well. I mean, right from the, you know, involving them right in the genesis of the idea, you know, helping them to actually, you know, brainstorm the idea through with them. It struck me as a very brave thing to do. Can you imagine doing that?
I think certainly there's so many experts within a business. It's tapping into that knowledge and getting the ideas from them. You know, marketing will have a lot of great ideas, but it's only really when you talk to the experts within the business that you can evolve them and get more ideas. So I think absolutely. And I think, you know, if you're dealing with, you know, a small business, a large business, the scale of it might be different, but the approach is still the same.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the idea that if you've scoped the problem together and explained it, that you're not coming back with a solution that's out of nowhere, you know, it's something where they've helped you define the problem. And so they know kind of more of the background to what the solution is. So it's not completely out of the blue to them.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And I think that's what, you know, really helps further down the line with their engagement and their support when the campaign is ready to go out the door. They're so much more willing to take part and support it and do their bit in promoting it if they've been involved, because there's a vested interest there. And I think that's what was obvious from the interview, that really helped in that instance. And I see that all the time.
Yeah, I think the thing that really stuck out to me is quite how much effort Mwamba went to behind the scenes. I mean, it felt like there was more work in the run-up to the campaign than the campaign itself. It was like, you know, one of those, you know, kind of an iceberg things. But I guess that you've got to do that because, I mean, I think, you know, we've all had, you know, great ideas, you know, that have been squashed on the route to going out live, I guess. I know I have. I mean, are there any particular things that stick out for you? You know, change the names to protect the innocent?
Yeah, we've all had those instances, haven't we? I think, you know, for me, I don't think I've had ideas killed as such, but I've certainly had ideas cut a little bit. You know, classic, where stakeholders particularly close to a situation or a client and are worried about what the client might think, or is it a bit too close to home, especially when we're working with data. So that's a classic where a company is using its own data, and there's naturally lots of sensitivities around that. So then naturally in those instances, you want to go out there with a very bold message, and there's just a little bit of sensitivity and you have to rein in a little bit. So I've had instances like that where we've had to subtly change a few words here and there. I do think it made a massive impact to the overall story, but the language became a little softer and a little less bold, shall we say.
And from your point of view, did that make things better or worse? Because I think that when Mwamba was talking about how she had to change the name of the campaign at the 11th hour, I think in hindsight, she probably feels that that's quite a good thing that happened. But similarly, I mean, I'm thinking of the research that we did at Radix earlier in the year. You know, 59% of B2B marketers think the sign-off process makes their results worse. You know, and so from your point of view, that kind of tempering of the language, is that something that's a benefit, or is that like a necessary evil that takes some of the impact away?
I think it's a necessary evil. I think, you know, the overall impact remained, and I think the benefits are if those stakeholders are happier and more engaged, and they're then going to support it when that content goes out, then that's a good thing. If that hadn't have changed, even as subtle as it was, I think that would have caused problems in terms of that engagement piece further down the line.
Yeah, absolutely. It was interesting to me the way that, as well as engaging the stakeholders, she was preparing, you know, the way around the world early on in the campaign creation process. And I know that a lot of the marketers that we deal with seem to have a challenge where they want the story to be consistent globally, but they also need content that resonates locally. You know, and there's that thing where there are local marketing people and salespeople in different territories who need their own spin, but somehow it doesn't always stay true to the thing that you started with. I mean, you've worked with sort of international companies. Is that the sort of thing that resonates for you?
To some extent, I think certainly with the brands I've worked with, the brand consistency, that global consistency, has pretty much remained. It's then how the regions execute on that content. You know, even if it's a case of the change an S for a Z, if they were in the States. Otherwise, I think it's then how they go out locally to reach the audience with that content. The core content for me has remained. It's just maybe slight language differentiations or how the campaign goes out the door and the types of people they reach and the way that they reach them.
And then are you kind of considering that those local angles, like when you're creating the story at the beginning? Because I guess some, you know, in some cultures, certain kinds of story will resonate everywhere and some won't, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's where the early engagement piece comes in. If you're working with a global business, it's getting everybody on board across those regions. And then that helps to get that straight from the beginning, so that you're not then creating the content and the campaign assets, asking everyone to roll it out, and then they come back to say to you, this isn't going to work for this region because... So embracing that early, and you know, that goes back to that early engagement piece, sales engagement piece. It all intertwines together there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a lot of work.
It is. And I think, you know, her approach was fantastic. Those brainstorms early on, creating champions and that social contract. That was a fabulous idea, you know, and making the campaign content as relevant. So that's where that piece comes in further down the line, is really identifying this is why it's relevant to you. This is what you need and why you need it. So, yeah, really interesting.
I think one of the things that really kind of came out again with this is the importance of having a clear story. So across all of the campaigns, across all of the you know, the different local areas and the versions and the assets,
it was that unifying central story of the coming talent crunch that it, I think, held everything together and made it coherent. And I know at B2B Ignite recently, it was just storytelling was everywhere. It was like the central theme of the 3 days. You know, but equally, we know that in, you know, B2B, people have to justify the decisions. They can't just get carried along emotionally. Where do you think storytelling fits in, you know, a B2B marketing campaign? How important is it?
I think it's really important. I think there's varying degrees of how that storytelling comes to life, particularly when you're working with very technical businesses. That can be really challenging because you're typically dealing with very technical people. So to bring in the more emotive and I suppose fluffy approach is very difficult for some people. I think it's really about bringing the project to life, so with real people, showing real impact, whether that's about emotion or bringing in humour, or just simply enabling a reader to associate themselves with the brand and the project. I don't think it needs to be any more than that in most instances. So whether that's through case studies or bringing it to life with the impact statistics and those local scenarios.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think a lot of people hear storytelling and they think it's all about their story as a business. It's all about like their brand's origin story. And yeah, sometimes that's interesting, you know, that big kind of Simon Sinek stuff. But it's, you're right. I think it's as much about the individual stories. I always think the most compelling story a brand has is the customer's story, and it's the part that you play in their story rather than expecting them to buy into your story. Because case studies are a perfect example, right? If you've got someone who you want to buy from you, the person you want them to identify with is the last person who bought from you and had their world or their job or their company transformed in that way. You don't want them to identify with you. You want them to identify with your customer so that they're in their shoes and they can understand why the last person bought and do the same.
Absolutely. I saw a really interesting video over the last few weeks. It was a case study testimonial video from a bank that they've been using a piece of software in the background. I can't remember the name of the software, so they shall remain anonymous. But how they approached the video was fantastic, because the product and the solution was never mentioned. It was done in such a way that the impact was very clear from the senior stakeholder in this bank telling the story. And it just had so much more impact because it wasn't pushing the product or the brand. It was very, very interesting and very well done.
Yeah, it's always a fine balance, because, you know, you want to be able to remember how it was that they did this thing. But yeah, it's customers got to be the hero of the story. And I think always think that's the most, you know, the most compelling stories that people have to tell usually are the ways that the customer use the thing that they're selling.
Before we go, it's the Anonymous Five, and this time we're talking to an IT director at a medium-sized UK business.
That's right. The Anonymous Five, if you remember, is our way of helping B2B marketers and writers to get behind the personas and hear the real kind of unvarnished truth from the real people doing the jobs. And this month, we're talking to an outsourced IT director who has a particular interest in cybersecurity.
The Anonymous Five.
Question one.
There's a common idea among B2B marketers that IT leaders won't engage with content if it's too technical because they're too far from the shop floor now. Is that true?
As an IT leader, I love technical content. There does need to be a balance, not making it too technical, but you need to show some details, otherwise it could be viewed as too simple and not much use to the reader. We always feel that content that contains some technical details will show your expertise in an area.
Question two.
What is your biggest workplace worry?
If we are discussing the area of content, I would say making sure that the content connects with the reader and engages them.
Question 3.
Do you actually bother to read marketing content like blogs, ebooks, and white papers, or don't you have time for that?
Emails. Sometimes if it catches my attention, I will usually know by looking at the title. Same for blogs, ebooks, and white papers. Yes, but it would usually be me searching for that content.
Question 4.
Is it possible to feel positive about cybersecurity, or is it just an ongoing pain in the bum that you'd like to minimise?
Definitely. We provide a cybersecurity roadmap which shows where we are now. Usually a block of red boxes of things they need to improve, and a proposal which has everything we would like to do. Usually a block of green boxes. As we move down the cybersecurity roadmap, all the red boxes start turning green and people do feel more positive and happy about it.
Question 5.
If you could wave a magic wand and change one thing about your job, what would it be?
Getting companies to take cybersecurity more seriously and realise they need a budget for it.
Thanks again to our IT director, and we've made a donation to Pregnancy Sickness Support on your behalf.
Angela, you've created marketing aimed at people in this kind of position, hasn't you? Did anything stand out there for you as a surprise?
No, I thought the question around, you know, reading content, I think that's obviously a key challenge for marketers, is to get people to read the content. And I think, you know, clearly some emails are picked up on, you know, clearly the subject line comes into place, which we see all the time as with blogs. So, yeah, that wasn't too big a surprise there. I think question one, where we talked about, you know, the technical amount of content, then, yeah, having that balance, it's always useful to try and achieve that. It's not always that possible, but knowing that is a good opportunity to push back with stakeholders when they want it all to be technical. So that's quite nice to hear.
It's often great, I think, to hear, you know, the reality from people, because often you kind of make assumptions about these things and then, you know, to find out which bits are true. I mean, I remember I've been telling people for years, you know, in the copywriting training that I do, that, you know, the blog title and maybe the first couple of words, you know, or the first couple of lines are really, you know, the bit that will govern whether it gets read or not. That's the bit where you have to deliver the value, because often they're just busy and often they won't read. So they need to get the point in 5 seconds flat. Even if they don't read, they kind of need to understand what you were going to tell them.
Absolutely.
And getting that value in really early is so important. It's so, you know, valuable to spend as much of the time available as you can on the title, on those first couple of lines of the copy, because it makes all the difference.
It does. And people skim read. So they'll read the intro, they'll look at the headings, the key points, that they're not going to read every single word on the page. So, you know, but yeah, maybe if you grab them, you know, in those first few words, maybe they will. But I think, yeah, absolutely, that intro is really important. That's all we have time for this month. Thanks for listening.
And thank you for co-hosting, Angela. It's been lovely to have been your first podcast. I do hope we can tempt you back in future.
Absolutely, yes. Thanks for having me. And yeah, I'd love to be involved in another one in the future.
Hasn't been too scary, I hope?
No, not too scary. No, that initial apprehension went very quickly. No, it's been great.
That's good to know.
Listener, do remember that if you'd like to get in touch, you can send us a voice memo to podcast@radix-communications.com or find us on Twitter @radixcom. That's RADIXCOM.
Thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, it's not coming up with new ideas that's difficult. It's escaping the old ones. Goodbye.